What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. It's another day of people who hate America showing their true colors and voicing it loudly. The Iranian legislature cheering death to America. That made the rounds on social media. You had Vladimir Putin saying that the attacks by Hamas are fault. Somehow he said that it's clear, a clear example of the failure of U.S. policy in the Middle East for not taking the core interests of the Palestinian people into account. And of course, the Republican Party blaming Biden. It's all Biden's fault. It's all Biden. Everything's Biden's fault. Never mind the fact that 4 years under Trump and Jared, because Jared was going to, you know, he was the Middle East master. He, you know, had it all, did it all. And of course, you got Tim Scott, which weird. Tim Scott has been kind of the, I think he believes this is what's going to get him some attention as he runs for president. He believes that it's all Biden's fault. Everything's Biden's fault. And that he, again, alone, like Trump, can fix it. Now, he had an interesting comment. He argues that America needs to return to a policy of strength. And I don't know what the heck he's talking about. And I get, there's a part of me that goes, okay, I get you believe that you know, right now we're weak. I know you believe that, that somehow our military, you know, very weak. Somehow, you know, just the change of a name on the door of the White House, that makes the military weak. You know, all the training they do, all the, you know, the command, all that. I kind of get it. But I don't know what the return to a policy of strength is. What are you going to do? What do you mean by a policy of strength in this situation, looking at Israel and Hamas and, you know, the whole Middle East? Do you mean putting boots on the ground? Are we going in? Are we suiting up? Are we getting involved? Are we going to start dropping stuff? Is that what you mean by a policy? Because I actually have no idea. And I don't think any of these people do either. Because I haven't heard any, hey, this is the way forward. I've heard he's the problem. It's Biden's fault. I've not heard anyone say this is how we fix the problem. Hey, look at me. I have the answer. I've heard a lot of people say, well, if it were me, they wouldn't have done this because, well, at least the one orange guy. Again, no plan, no plot, no idea, no vision, no thoughts, just rhetoric. I did find it cute that Fox News, blaming Joe Biden, blamed Biden for... how did one of the hosts put it? For the lack of Senate confirmed elected officials? That was verbatim. It was Biden's fault for not having, for having a lack of Senate confirmed elected officials. And you look at that statement and you go, well, elected officials are elected. Senate confirmed officials are Senate confirmed. That's the nature of advise and consent. The president, who is elected, an elected official, he puts forth a nominee. The Senate advises and consents, and that's how that they get confirmed. That's how this works. But we're in a moment where the Republicans, in their role of advising and consenting, are not. And you look at Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the Senate, who since February has had a near total blockade on any confirmations of military officers. Well over 300 military officers are waiting for their confirmations. And it turns out this little thing in Israel, this whole dust up over there, that's not going to move him to lift the blockade of our military nominations. No, especially when you have Tim Scott saying, we need policy of strength. Someone want to tell them that this is kind of the time when we need functional government, when we need adults in the room to do their jobs? I don't know. But look, it's not this idiot Tuberville. It's most of them. I look at J.D. Vance. He's had a hold on DOJ nominations for a while because they indicted Donald Trump. Well, we'll show you. We're not gonna let you do your job. We're not gonna appoint anyone. Josh Hawley's had a hold on people at the Department of Energy because something with radioactive waste in St. Louis that he who even knows. Chuck Grassley's got a hold on the Deputy Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Again, I don't even think he knows why. Rand Paul had a two-month hold on the State Department nominees because of documents believes existed, who knows, over COVID. And you've got Fox News blaming Biden for not getting people confirmed? When we've got these idiots in the Senate? And look, never let a good crisis go to waste. Josh Hawley floated the idea of cutting off funding to Ukraine so they could give it to Israel. And of course, good on one of the people who survived the attack, basically saying, what are you, stupid? And the answer is, yeah. This person, tweeted back, what a cynical move that you would do this. Shame on you, Senator. Iran is sending drones to Ukraine and guns to Gaza to murder Ukrainians and murder Israelis. God help us if USA can't support both countries against this brutal anti-democratic axis. Glad Biden is in charge. And I gotta tell you, I absolutely agree. Because here's the thing. I fear authoritarianism is on the rise. I fear the wannabe dictators, the people who would side with Putin, the folks who are doing Putin's, carrying of the Putin water. Our Republican friends. It used to be, we talked about this yesterday a little bit. It used to be these kind of divides stopped at the water's edge. We beat each other up over, internal stuff, over family stuff. But when it went out into the international community, we had a sense of strength. When there was an attack, we came together. I fear in a moment of heaven forbid, another 9/11 type attack. It's not a moment of unity. It's not a moment of, hey, let's all pull together and be one, that it then becomes used against, hey, they're not American enough. And it's used by some. I'm looking at the orange guy as an opportunity to consolidate power, to set aside democratic norms, to overstep institutional policy, to grasp control. And look, we've had our moments in this country of interesting kind of dealings. And today I had a conversation with someone who reminded me, you know, because we were talking about Iran, we were talking about the Middle East, and brought up the idea, the 1980 election, and brought up the fact that, and we now know to be accurate, that the Reagan campaign had something to do with the people who were holding the hostages in Iran. And it used to, for my whole life, it was a conspiracy theory. You know, George H.W. Bush, who was head of the CIA, you know, hold on to them a little bit longer, you know, let them go as we put our hand in the Bible. It's a good image. It's a Hollywood movie. It's well scripted. And it was such a great myth. You know, the Gipper puts his hand on the book and the world shivers. It was such a good narrative. The sad reality is I fear that kind of narrative making isn't for good. And as we move forward, it becomes something that is used to destroy democracy across the globe. And as I said yesterday, I don't have the answers on what's going on in Israel and with Hamas and the Palestinians. I know a lot of poor people are going to die. I know there's going to be misery. I know we're going to see horrible atrocities all over the place. And nobody has a solution. Nobody seems to be coming forth with, hey, this is what we do. It's now all about feeding your confirmation bias. And that's what's frustrating to me. In our news media, it's all about the clicks. It's all about the attention. It's all about the, hey, look over here. All the while, poor and working class people around the globe are getting poorer and more desperate and more divided. For me, that's where this is. Instead of going, hey, there's a way forward, we're siding up into teams. Want to hear your thoughts. Lots to get to on this. Lots to talk about. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, still don't have a speaker. And again, this is another one of those moments where, you know, the globe is in chaos. People are looking to the U.S. for leadership. And, well, welcome to chaos. Hakeem Jeffries has been renominated as the Democratic leader, the candidate for speaker by the Democrats. Republicans still, who knows? We will see. Let's go to the phones. Got Steve in Chicago on one. Steve, how are you today?
Yes, I'm fine, all things considered. And I think that you made a really great point with regard to media, because you can't have this discussion without talking about that. And the reality is that though people may want to sort of idealize the what media is supposed to be, it's not a bunch of people who are journalists working for a news outlet that's bringing you what's going on in the world. No, I mean, that perhaps was at one time what some of them did. Today, it's about bringing you to advertisers. And unfortunately, given the nature of these large media organizations and conglomerates, it's just the case that it's about the bottom line. So it's not always that they have some agenda in terms of getting someone like a Trump elected or someone else. It's just that the kind of soundbite-ish quality that defines modern media, you know, we live in this Twitter-esque society, I guess, what is it, X now?
Yeah.
You know, I always thought that, well, who in God's name would want to have a Twitter account? I never had one. Why? Because you can't get a coherent thought out in that many characters. So why would I want one? Yet, you know, a lot of people buy into it, and I understand people have careers, and they need to be on social media, so they need to be on there. But honestly, what does it do for you in terms of, you know, enlightening you about what's going on in the world? And that caters to the conservative mind. So, and so in this alternative universe of their media, you can actually articulate a position that says that it's Joe Biden's fault that Republicans refuse to confirm his nominee. I mean, that's just an alternative universe.
Yeah.
And they believe it, and because they know that a lot of their voters don't do anything about this with regard to being intellectually curious, looking it up, doing a little bit of research. No, no, no. We'll just go along with their narrative, and that narrative says Joe Biden is to blame. And why? Because some conservative outlet told me that, you know, he couldn't get his people into office. He couldn't get them in office because Republicans refused to confirm them, for God's sakes. But that requires, you know, 2 seconds of research. So, yeah, it's frightening because, you know, one of the things that we've learned in the last few hundred years about democracy is that for it to function properly, people actually have to take the time out of their lives to do something with regard to becoming educated voters, because stupid voters lead to bad government. And I would love the idea, there's part of me at least that would love the idea that only the best and brightest would vote. We could pick 100,000 of the best and brightest people in the country, and they would decide who would run our government. But that's not democracy. So instead, we allow everyone to cast a vote. I spent 12 years of my life after I graduated high school earning 3 different degrees, including a doctorate in political science. I would contend that I know something more than most people about the field, but that doesn't mean that my vote counts any more than anybody else's. But on anything else, if you were to ask, what are we going to do about this patient who has heart disease? Well, the guy over here is a cardiologist. What he thinks matters more than what 20,000 other people who have no such credentials think. And the same thing with regard to law, the same thing with regard to economics. I mean, you could just go down a long list of things. We always have this belief that it's perfectly legitimate to defer to people who know what they're doing in most fields. Yet when it comes to public policy, apparently everybody's got an opinion, and everybody's opinion is supposed to carry equal weight.
Yeah.
No, that's not what it means. You have a right to free speech in this society. You don't have a right to your own facts. And that's so there is such a thing as radical egalitarianism, and unfortunately, a lot of media, they've been played as, you know, by the reps, as it were. So it's this idea that, well, you know, we're all liberals, and if you're part of the media, then you're catering to liberals. So, you know what, as Republicans and conservatives, we're going to work the reps, and we're going to make sure that our voice gets heard as much as the other side, despite the fact that what we're trying to say is ludicrous. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but you don't sell, you know, geography next to flat earth science for a reason, because those are not things that are equally debated. You can have a debate about the top marginal tax rate. Two people can agree to disagree on what that should be. But there are some things which are just settled. And unfortunately, that's not what we see in media today. There are just the most crazy conspiracy theories out there. Alex Jones had a following that was larger than a lot of cable news outlets at the height of his career. And we all know what he thought, you know, with regard to what was going on in the world. So, yeah, this is an epistemological crisis that exists in this country. And until we address it, I don't know how we're going to change the direction in which we're moving.
Yeah, I don't know. Is that whole flat Earth thing, is that settled? Because, you know, I walked into a classroom recently and they had a globe and a map on the wall. So there was the round one and the flat one. I don't know.
Well, you know, I mean, and I use that example specifically because since the age of social media took hold, the number of people has quadrupled in terms of who believes that the Earth could potentially be flat. And they're getting this exactly from these places. They'll go on to some ridiculous site on YouTube or somewhere else, and someone will tell them, look, this is the science. It's not science what they're offering. It's some ridiculous idiot who thinks that this is science. Yeah. It could be disproven in 2 seconds. But people buy into it, and all of a sudden, now, given, if you believe the Earth is flat, I think you're pretty harmless. But if you think that the vaccine is going to sterilize you, COVID vaccine is going to sterilize you, if you think the election was stolen, yeah, those things actually have a potential to harm the society in which you live. That's dangerous, unlike the flat Earth belief nonsense. Yeah. So that's the problem.
Now, the thing that gets me is, you know, the flat Earth folks and a lot of the conspiracy folks, you know, they do their research. And you, as someone who has advanced degrees, actually knows what research is. So one of the things out of the pandemic that I find most offensive and most ridiculous is this phrase, do your own research. Because I don't think we in this country actually know what research is. You know, we had a guest on the show not too long ago who said, you know, doing research isn't, you know, sitting on the can with your mouth open watching YouTube videos. And I agree with that. That's not research.
Exactly. We teach kids in high school that when you're going to write your first research paper, so, you know, if you hope to go on to college, this tends to be part of the curriculum, you can't use something like a secondary source. In other words, the New York Times, as great a newspaper and a journalistic outlet as it is, it is not considered proper sourcing. It is a secondary source. So, yet we have people in this country who think, as you point out, YouTube videos. I mean, we can't use the New York Times for high school students isn't legitimate, but other people think YouTube videos are. You're not an adult, so when we say, you know, you need to do your own research, okay, great, if provided that people understand what methodology means and what research and statistical analysis means and what's good and what's bad, you know. When Fox News does a poll and says, okay, our viewers, go and tell us what you think about this, okay, that there's a problem there. It's a self-selection problem. The people watching Fox News are not representative of this country. So when they say 80% of our viewers reject what Joe Biden has offered up in this public policy initiative, well, yeah, because it's Fox News viewers. It's not American.
Yep.
And somebody will say, well, this is what the Fox News poll said. Yeah, again, because you don't understand research methodology.
Yeah, but they do, and this is the part that gets me. They do understand it. They don't care. It's all about, again, back to the Les Moonves comment. You know, you know, Trump may be bad for America, but he's good for the bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm hoping that moving forward, that some of the media in this country actually sit down and have a discussion and say, you know, what we did in 2016 in service of the bottom line was not in service of this society and our democracy.
Yeah, don't hold your breath.
Just because Donald Trump says it, and just because he says it, and just because people are willing to watch it, and it'll boost our ratings, does not mean we have to air it. So let's have that discussion in those newsrooms. But I'm wondering who's got the guts to do that.
None of them. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about the money, Steve. And I think you know that as well as anyone.
True. Take care.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much. No, I have these conversations often, you know, as, you know, doing what I do. And this is not a news program. I'll be the first to tell you that. I am not breaking news. I am not, you know, not telling. I'm looking at news and I'm telling you what my thoughts are. This is about me as much as it is anything else. I want our news people to be unbiased as much as they can. I want them to present reality, but I also want them to say this is BS. There's nothing to corroborate the lies and insanity that come out of some of our elected officials' mouths. There is a moment where, and as I've been saying for some time now, Republicans are lying a little differently right now. You know, politicians have always lied to us, and I've been saying this for a while. They've always lied in certain ways. They've always spun reality, twisted into a pretzel. But there's always been that kernel. There's always been that grain of salt that's going, yeah, this is the fact. I look now and I'm not finding that grain of salt anywhere. I'm finding just total BS from a lot of these people. because they've spun their own alternative reality. How you come up with the flat earth stuff, beyond me. How you come up with a lot of the Q stuff, well beyond me. You know, I've had conversations with the Red Hats who believe that in every classroom there's a cat box, you know, that, you know, at lunchtime they've got transition services, you know, right in the schools. I mean, the things that my Red Hat friends believe are incredulous. It's I don't know how you get there. Well, I do. You're submersed in Fox, in OAM, in Newsmax, and worse. You're the flat earthers, only worse. Hopefully we do better. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got a lot to get to. When we come back, Scott Paul is going to be here to share some thoughts on our trade numbers, our job numbers, and much more. Back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I tell this all the time whenever I talk about manufacturing. I've been through Trenton, New Jersey. You know, when I was on the road, I used to go through Trenton all the time. We had a terminal there. And we always went over that bridge that had on the side of it, Trenton makes the world tanks lit up in real bright lights. Sense of pride for the community. Sense of pride for the country. Because we used to be the manufacturer of the globe. We used to make stuff. Lots of stuff. Not just stuff for ourselves, but stuff for everybody else. Stuff we shipped around the world. Again, sense of pride. When I was a kid, blue jeans in the Soviet Union was the thing. Everybody, American blue jeans were just... Now, good luck finding a pair of American-made blue jeans. But I saw this story about building big ocean vessels. Evidently, we produced just 10 of these big ocean vessels last year, where China, 1,000. Understand, we used to be, again, number one. We used to be the commercial shipbuilder of the world. Not anymore. I guess we've fallen to, what, 19th? And here to share some thoughts on, well, how did this happen and how do we return to, probably never going to get back to number one, but how do we, well, at least build what we need, domestic production for domestic consumption. That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, americanmanufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, good to be with you.
So what do you make of this? You know, just 10 of these big kind of ship thingies. So what are we talking about? Oceanic vessels. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, these are the container ships. I mean, these are the big boys that get cargo around the world, and we depend on it for getting exports out of the United States. And also, we obviously import a lot of goods, as we've discussed. Some of those, you know, we really do need. And the challenge is, unfortunately, that with respect to the shipping, we don't control our own destiny because we just don't make these things anymore. And that has spillover effects into the military sector as well. It's just a loss of innovation, a loss of know-how, a loss of repair capacity. And Rick, you teed it up perfectly. I mean, the disparity with China is just enormous. I mean, the fact that, you know, we're a country that our main, you know, military strength for really all of our history has been measured in terms of the tonnage of our Navy, right? And we build it up. And we had the biggest Navy in the world. We had an enormous merchant marine. We had two oceans between us and the nearest adversary. But it was that merchant marine and that Navy that really helped to project our soft power and our hard power. And the truth is that we have been in relative decline for decades, both on the merchant marine, the civilian side, which coincides with subsidies for shipbuilding ending in the Reagan administration, by the way. And on the military side, too, where we have just, you know, we've downsized the number of shipyards that we have working in the United States. And, you know, China's scaled up its Navy big time. And so we have kind of these dual challenges that we have to face, because I get very uncomfortable if we don't have some control over our own destiny here. And we're losing that right now.
No, I mean, I look at this and, you know, when I saw this, my first thought was obviously, you know, as you pointed out, right to military, right to national security, thought back to stories my grandfather told me of, you know, turning the old IX Center in Cleveland into a tank plant. I forget what it was beforehand, turning the auto industry into, you know, they made planes and, you know, tanks and all kinds of weaponry for World War II. We don't have that manufacturing capacity anymore. And to go from, you know, being able to be the world's producer of these large vessels, these ships, to now being, you know, 19th with the capacity of building just 10 of them. I look at the chaos in the world. I look at the chaos here at home, and I'm concerned about the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And rightfully so. And this isn't just about national security. This is also about jobs and skills and capabilities as well. And the fact that we have a limited capacity to repair vessels, in fact, we can only do about 36% of the demand out there for the repair, or that we've downsized the shipyards, means that the number of people who possess the skills to do this is frighteningly small. And it's not the workers' fault. So let's be clear about that. It's just because we have really downsized the sector. And so scaling it up, and you just mentioned this, and, you know, God forbid we need to do that, but we may. You look at the world and you're absolutely right. We have to be prepared to do that. And the fact is, we would be woefully unprepared right now if we needed to scale up construction either of our merchant marine. If for some reason China said, well, we're just not going to use our ships to carry your goods anymore, right? Or our Navy. And so, you know, it's a, you know, 10 ships a year compared to 1,000. I mean, that kind of output, anybody can do the math and know, even if we have the technical superiority, the volume is going to catch up with us, and we definitely have a long way to go.
And that's just this one thing. How many other things that we used to manufacture for ourselves, produce for ourselves, that we were the global leader in, that we've given away? And I no longer say we've lost, you know, manufacturing jobs. We've lost manufacturing capacity. We didn't lose it. We know exactly where it is. We gave it away.
That's right.
And how much of it is, because, you know, I argue with friends about this all the time. How much of it is, you know, it was the end of history after the fall of the Soviet Union. We thought, hey, you know, now the globe is a safe place. We can all trade with each other, and people who trade with each other don't fight. And, you know, rice and beans and all that garbage we were taught in economics course. So, you know, the world is corporate America's oyster, and them moving. And how much of it was just corporate greed, where they're just going, hey, screw America. We're going to go find cheap exploitable labor and it lacks environmental regulations so we can fatten our bottom lines. Or was it all of the above?
Yeah, I think it is all of the above. It's a little bit of that wishful thinking. It's a little bit of that greed and that misguided philosophy that if you have strong economic relations with countries, they'll never fight again, which has turned out not to be true. And so, yes, we let it slide. And even before that, you know, when, you know, Reagan ended the shipbuilding subsidies because he thought it was against free market, not understanding that, you know, shipbuilding, merchant marine, that's like a public good as well, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that comes out of that, and so we really eroded that capacity. Rick, I do think, look, there are a couple of encouraging signs. You know, despite all of these horrible stories we've been telling, and that is that I think that there's some recognition that this is a problem. And for instance, we recognize it with semiconductors, and now there's a program to construct semiconductor factories in the United States. And it is very successful. It's doing exactly what it's intended to do. It's scaling up a massive amount of semiconductor manufacturing in the United States. I would argue that there are other sectors where it's important that we do that. I think pharmaceuticals is one. I think we ought to make more of our pharmaceuticals. I think shipbuilding is one, because we have both the civilian and the military need for a modern fleet. And simply being able to churn out 10 ships a year compared to 1,000, that is a real problem. But I think that we know that if we invest some resources in it, that we can make this happen. But we have to have the political will and to do that. And we also have to, you're right, Rick, challenge those corporations who are just interested in making bigger margins, bigger returns for their shareholders, not taking into account the impact that that's having on our economic and national security in the United States, nor facing any consequences for that.
The consequences being the important part. You know, I've had a lot of conversations recently about people with corporate America going, oh, we need to ask them to do nice things. And, you know, basically, you know, asking them to be benevolent. And I don't believe in benevolent corporate leaders. I don't believe in benevolence. I believe in the carrots and sticks. I believe in getting people to do what they need to do. And if they don't, you know, holding them accountable. Which is why I look at what we've allowed corporate America to get away with. They were bad policy decisions. And as you pointed out, thank you, Ronald Reagan, for helping destroy the shipbuilding industry by gutting the subsidies. And again, it's that ideology that I believe they knew even then as they were pushing. They knew what they were doing. They were destroying the industries here so that they would go elsewhere, so that they could pocket more money, destroy unions, destroy the prosperous working class, and take back... get us back to desperation where we are now. But that's a whole nother argument. But bad policy got us here. Good policy can get us out.
Yes, and that is absolutely correct. I do think that with the right industrial policy, we can reinvigorate industries like shipbuilding that, again, everybody takes it for granted. No one thinks about this until there's a problem. But when there's a problem, it becomes a massive problem.
Yeah.
And if it's a matter of we're not able to replace the Navy ships out there and we're getting into a hot situation, that is not when you want to test this theory, right? Or if China says, you know what, we're going to keep the merchant marine for ourselves and y'all are going to have to figure out another way to get goods around the world. And again, this may not be a likely possibility, but it is something that you cannot discount. And so under either of those scenarios, we are not prepared. And again, when we saw this with semiconductors, we said, okay, let's do this. And it was bipartisan. There were Democrats and Republicans who said, look, let's put this together. And now we have a policy, and now we have new semiconductor factories all over the country. You know, in Arizona and Indiana and Ohio and Texas and New York and a bunch of other places, too. So let's reinvigorate the shipyards. We have four of them. Let's get four more open. Let's get a new generation of shipyard workers who, by the way, are unionized, which is awesome in most parts of the country. And let's put them to work and let's build some more ships so that we have more control all over our own, you know, merchant marine destiny and our, you know, U.S. Navy destiny as well. Yeah. And I think we'll be better off for it.
Yeah, and it's not just about, you know, the ships themselves. It's about everything that goes into them as well. I mean, think of absolutely all the steel and all the, you know, the aluminum and the rubber and, you know, everything that goes into this, all the machined parts and all of the potential industry that could spur around that we've lost. It's not just the capacity of putting it together. It's everything, all of the inputs. It's all of this stuff that could revive an industrial base. And I, the reason I bring up the military, and you rightfully so said, you know, it doesn't always have to be military. I believe the only reason we do things in this country is military. I think that's the only reason we have urgency. You know, but you go back 100 years, the only reason we got school milk programs is because kids weren't, you know, healthy enough to carry weapons into war. So we got milk programs into schools. If we can't get milk into the classroom, you know, without talking about weapons. Ships are fired on the list. So for me, if it gets us our industries back and it gets us moving in the right direction, I think that's what we got to talk about.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. And so my hope is that there'll be more attention that's paid to this issue, and that we aren't afraid to explore the solutions like we did with semiconductors, to both push back against unfair trade practices because it's allowed China to dominate this global industry, but also the fact that we've had this paucity of domestic investment, that's hurt us too. But again, we know the formula. We know what will work here. We have to execute it.
Now, one of the things you and I have talked about for years is just how bad our trade deficit is, you know, not just, you know, with the world, but especially with China. And yet there has been a pretty sizable decline in trade, in our trade deficit with China. And look, I want to trade with China. I want to have good relations with China. Nobody wants an enemy there, but you can't keep being in the dumping ground for the Chinese communist government to be able to dump, you know, cheap garbage here.
Yeah.
But I guess a year over year down a third, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting development, and there's a couple of things that we can draw from this. First is that there is a very real kind of de-risking that's happened. There is less being pulled directly out of China, and coming from other countries like Vietnam, Mexico, instead. So you see that. Okay, that's number one. I think number two, and I think this is something we have to keep our eye on, is that I think the Chinese government and Chinese companies connected to the government are aware of the sensitivity of this trade deficit or of this. And so they're also playing some games and routing products through other countries. And we've seen this. And so we also have to look along with those, the change in the trade flows, as, you know, follow the Chinese investment too. And if it's just a Chinese investment in Mexico, and we're seeing that product coming from Mexico, but it's from the Chinese company, that's still of concern, I think, in a number of ways. But the trend is real. That number is coming down. I'd like to see our overall trade deficit come down that much. We're not there yet. We're not at 33%. But we have both the tariffs that were put into place in the last administration, some of the domestic investments we've seen, and then some of the companies realizing that their own investments in China aren't necessarily secure, along with the Chinese government knowing that, you know, we gotta start playing the whack-a-mole kind of shell game a little bit, I think has contributed to this dynamic. And I don't think it's reversible. I think it's going to continue to head down a little bit. But that doesn't mean that unfair trade practices, subsidies, Chinese investment isn't a problem anymore. It's just shifted, I think, to maybe other areas of the world.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm thrilled with what Joe Biden's doing. I'm thrilled with the fact that we've got something of an industrial policy. We're reshoring manufacturing. We're having conversations about domestic production for domestic consumption. I think we're heading in a good direction, something we need to continue. But I'm sure it's something that we'll talk about down the road as things continue. I appreciate the time, Scott. As always, good stuff. Appreciate it.
Likewise, Rick, thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott Paul is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Gonna take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come the talk.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. At 2:02 in the afternoon, President Woodrow Wilson at the White House touched off an explosion at the Gamboa Dike in Panama. With that touch of a button, the last barrier to joining the waters of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans through the Panama Canal went up in smoke. The Chicago Tribune described the scene in Panama, writing, quote, "Then suddenly came the muffled roar of the discharge of 1,600 pounds of dynamite, which sent a shower of water, mud, and rock high into the air. Spreading out as it went upward, the hole heavily veiled into a cloud of smoke. As water began to pour through the rent made by the explosion, the crowd sent up a great cheer. It was a noteworthy moment in the construction of the canal, but that moment came at a staggering cost of workers' lives. For more than 20 years, the French and then the United States worked on the canal project. The U.S. phase lasted for a decade. As many as 45,000 workers toiled on the canal during the peak years of construction. These workers came from the United States, Europe, Asia, and Panama. West Indians formed the core of the work crews. These workers faced stifling heat, brutal working conditions, and poor accommodations. Workers had to contend with ravaging disease, poisonous snakes, and torrential rains. Workers also faced racial discrimination. For example, West Indian workers earned half the hourly wages of U.S. and European workers. They also lived in much more crowded barracks. Worker deaths were so frequent that death or funerary trains made continual runs to bring the bodies away from the construction site. It is estimated that more than 27,000 men died building the canal.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I had the weirdest thing happen. I happened to be going through, flipping through Facebook, and there was a baseball card site that had, you know, like an old baseball card that I remember having as a kid. And, you know, whenever I see them, I go, hey, whatever happened to that person? And it happened to be Steve Garvey, who was the first baseman for the Dodgers back in the 70s and early 80s. And I go, gee, I wonder what happened to Steve Garvey. He was an all-star. He was a great player. So I said, I'll Google. I'll find out what happened to Steve Garvey. Evidently, this is so completely just out of the blue. I looked this up. Turns out today he announced that he's going to run for Senate in California as a Republican. It's just the weirdest kind of, you know, normally I looked him up and you go, oh, you know, he did this or did that. Or usually it's, you know, sadly, it's a lot of tragedy. But, you know, here, although this could be tragedy too. You know, you could end up with a crazy right winger. Who knows? But yeah, there you go. Steve Garvey's running for Senate in California. He's going to give the folks of left-leaning California, so the story goes, an opportunity to vote for their hero. Let's go to the phones. I got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane.
So what's on your mind?
So, well, you're complaining about right-wingers. I'm trying to be nice here.
Okay.
You know, they're just the most ignorant bunch, and they don't do research. And I've got a perfect example for you.
Hit me.
I think I've told you before about, you know, I've been involved in genealogy for years, you know, at least 20. And my cousin Jan, who lives in Seattle, Washington, has extensively researched, and I mean gone to the archives in D.C. and the whole nine yards, our family tree on the Adams-Wilson side. Now, I am of triracial heritage. I have Native American, African American, and, of course, Caucasian. So the Adam Wilsons is our mixed race side. So she sends me an email today, and she said, hey, did you go on Find a Grave and make an entry for a Jasper Denton Adams? And she proceeded to go on, and I guess whoever had made this had put down Denton's wife's name and connected it. So I went and hunted up, I said, who the heck did this? Because Jasper Adams would have been my two times great-grandfather. Jasper was his brother, and they both died at Andersonville prison camp in Georgia. Grandfather Denton had been captured at the Battle of the Wilderness, and Jasper had been captured before then. And they both had joined in Ohio and joined the infantry. So I sent this guy an email, and I said, look, you're thoroughly confused. You know, and I proceeded to tell him where he screwed up in the whole nine yards. And I said, you've got my cousin Jan upset too. Well, cousin Jan, being the researcher that she is, she went and found out that the guy who did this is some right-wing guy who is living in Mexico but is originally from Arkansas, who has put together and just totally screwed up all kind of stuff on the family tree. So I was like, do these people not research? I mean, how hard is it?
No, yeah. No, look, they're just selling stuff. It's a product.
Yeah, it is, but I thought, you know, they can't research anything. My God, not even genealogy.
Well,
they got, you know, they've got...
That's why it's good to have you there to keep the tree well trimmed.
No, that's Cousin Jan. She's worse than I am. But have a good evening, Rick.
Thank you, Alice. Appreciate it. I'm terrible at that. I had a relative, you know, contact me the other day and ask me, you know, if I knew anything about, you know, this other side of our family. They had done one side of our family, my grandfather's side of the family. They actually went back to, because I was just checking here a second ago, because she sent me all the paper, back to 1695. Evidently, on my grandfather's side, on his mother's side, she was a Pamunkey Indian, goes back to the days of almost John Smith. And all of that, it's really quite fascinating when you stop and think about it. But I don't do that kind of research. That's a lot of work. But appreciate the thoughts, Alice. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, still no speaker. And again, I'm still pulling for Donald Trump. I'll be honest. I'm still hoping that they pull the Trump out of the bag and make Trump, even if it's just for 90 days. And I hope, you know, Marjorie Three Names gets her wish, that it's a MAGA rally every day. Because I think the American people need to see this on display. I think it'd be good for the country. I think it would be cathartic. I think it would make us... I hope it would scare the hell out of people and make us go, hey, this is not good. This is bad. But we're going to get stuck with the second tier, either Jim Jordan or Steve Scalise, or maybe someone who hasn't appeared just yet here to help us work through who may be speaker, if we ever get one, if there is someone who actually wants it. So I've asked our good friend, former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh, to come share some thoughts with us. He is also the host of the White Flag with Joe Walsh podcast, one of the great podcasts out there. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, I love being on your radio show.
As you should, because the reality is...
Even though, by the way, even though you piss me off sometimes, but go ahead.
Well, better off than on. So here's the thing. And then look, you have very few places where people who disagree have a civil, reasonable, actual conversation. Are we going to get a speaker? Is this going to happen? Will eventually there be someone dumb enough to go, yeah, I want it?
Yeah, because there has to be. I don't think we'll get one right away. I don't think we'll get one in the next couple days. Look, Rick, my former political party, really last week, my former political party screamed to the American people that they are incapable of governing. Please put the Democrats in control of the House. I think that's what they did. Yep. And I think last week gave the Democrats control of the House. I don't think it matters who the next speaker is.
No. And I think this week they're just hammering those nails in the coffin, because look, you've got what's going on over in Israel. The president said, hey, we need to send money over there. There's no money to be sent because, you know, Congress has got to be the one that the House is where this spending has to emanate from. And without a functional House, I don't know how we're getting it over there.
That's right. Nothing can happen when it comes to money out of Congress without the House. And the House can't do anything, Rick, until or unless they have a speaker. I don't think Republicans want to show an ugly public fight this week. I've been told by some of my former colleagues that they have to bang this out in private. And when they take it to the floor, they'll take it knowing that somebody has the votes, because they don't want to go through, Rick, what they went through in this past January with McCarthy.
Yeah. And whoever eventually gets it has to get rid of that rule that one person can oust them.
I disagree. And you know what? And I think a lot, I know you know this. I bet a lot of your listeners don't. That rule has been in place since our founding for most of our history. Nancy Pelosi, who I like, changed it, but it's the people's house. And I think any member of Congress should have a right to make that motion, and then the House should vote. That's not the problem. To me, the problem is, oh, I got to watch my language. To me, the problem is a jackass like Matt Gaetz, who puts his own interest ahead of the interest of the House.
Yeah, so good. You watched your language. You swore anyway.
I watched my language. I watched it very carefully.
Right as it shot out your mouth. Okay, I can understand that. You know, but at the end of the day, if you're a speaker, you got to have some. If you're going to put yourself through all this, you got to have some assertion that, you know, that you're going to be able to finish the tenure, and at the end of it, you know, you're going to be able to. Then you can throw the bum out. You're not going to have to be looking over your shoulder after every single decision you make throughout the term, though. No.
Well, but that's what's interesting, Rick. Remember that rule's been with us for most of our country's history. The one member can move. And I think a lot of people don't realize that even though the majority picks the speaker is the speaker of the whole House.
Right.
So a Democrat could have moved on a vote to vacate Kevin McCarthy. But that aside, I think the Republicans privately are going to struggle. I don't think right now Jim Jordan or Steve Scalise, who I served with, I don't think either of them are close to getting the votes now. And if they can't over the next day or two, I think you'll see maybe a consensus candidate.
Yeah. So who's that going to be? Because I don't think either one of them are going to be. And look, I've had conversations recently with some folks who no, it's going to be you know, Scalise, or it's going to be Jordan. It's going to be one of them. And I'm going, I don't know. I think they're too extreme. I think they got too much baggage. I mean, Scalise, you know, this whole idea, and I don't even know what this means. The statement that's been attributed to him is he's David Duke without the baggage. I don't know what that means. Does it mean he's racist? I don't know, but he doesn't, you know, have the hood. I'm not sure, but that's attributed to him. And then all the Jim Jordan stuff with the stuff at Ohio State. I don't know why you'd even put yourself in the run with this, knowing that stuff's hanging over you.
Remember, Rick, and you said something interesting. You said both Jordan and Scalise are too extreme. Huh? In this party, they are the party. Like, we forget that this is a MAGA party. And as far as the Republican Party, ever since Donald Trump, no personal baggage or scandals matter. Not for these Republican voters. I think they're too closely aligned. That not they're both going to get a bunch of votes, but not close. And so, again, I don't think Republicans want to carry this beyond this week because they look horrible. So I can then see them grabbing somebody else because, Rick, I don't think Matt Gaetz and the other seven care who the next speaker is. They just wanted McCarthy's scalp.
Yeah, they just most certainly wanted that head on the wall. So any thoughts on who that consensus candidate could be? I've had people go, no, it's going to be Hakeem Jeffries. I'm going, it's never going to be Hakeem Jeffries. Yeah. That is never going to happen. Stop with the fantasy.
I think that if Scalise and Jordan don't come close and can't get there, I could see the House rallying around Patrick McHenry, who's the interim speaker right now. I think he's third in leadership. Or keep your eyes on an old guy who's been there forever, Tom Cole out of Oklahoma. He's just a good old boy, a good, simple moderate. Whoever's going to be a speaker, Rick, is going to be a caretaker. it doesn't matter who the speaker is, because the next year is going to be continued chaos, dysfunction, and incompetence, no matter who the speaker is.
Yeah, but we've got, I don't know if you've checked your calendar, but we got about 30 days. About 30 days until the next debt crisis, puts the world on notice that we may default on some stuff. We may shut down the government. Who knows what we're going to do next? But we got about 30 days before Thanksgiving, and who knows if they kick it before Christmas, or who knows? Should have some functional leadership, don't you think?
Yes, but Rick, the party is dysfunctional. Donald Trump is the leader of the party. He's going to be the nominee. You almost could make an argument that it's no longer a political party. When it comes to the shutdown in 30 days, both Jordan and Scalise said today to their Republican colleagues, they're going to push another continuing resolution no matter what. So we're going to continue to do that, just live by continuing resolution. So I don't think that's going to be an issue. I'm more concerned about, like, Israel, getting money and stuff to Israel right now.
Right.
And we can't do that without a speaker.
So, if we can't get any money to Israel, what does Biden do? And is it, I guess, let me ask you this. Is this Biden's fault? Is it all Biden's fault? I saw Fox News say that it was Biden's fault since, what was the quote? Couldn't get, what was this? Hold on, I'll find it. It couldn't get...
Who?
What's going on this attack on Israel is Biden's fault for not getting his people confirmed. It's Biden's fault for the lack of Senate confirmed elected officials was the exact quote, which is, I love Fox News. Love me some Fox News. Is it Biden's fault?
Not at all. Look, Rick, I am off the charts pro-Israel. When I was in Congress, I was the most pro-Israel member of Congress. Joe Biden has always been a good, loyal friend of Israel's. Man, Rick, I bet you heard his speech today.
I did.
That was one of the clearest, strongest expressions of support for Israel I've ever seen from an American president. I don't think Biden has been strong enough with Iran. But no, this isn't Biden's fault. This is Iran's fault. This is Russia's fault. This is Hamas's fault.
So, in moving forward, because, I saw Tim Scott's statement that, this is all Joe Biden's fault because, evidently we're weak.
No, Rick, it was even worse.
Hold on. I'm getting to it. He says that we need to return to strength.
No, I thought he said, yeah, Hamas did it. But Joe Biden has blood on his hands.
That was yesterday.
My God, what a despicable thing to say. You know what, Rick? I'm always blown away by all my former colleagues who sold their soul to Trump. I always thought, I never thought Tim Scott would. I went to Congress with him. I thought he was a decent guy. He sold his soul to Trump. That is one of the ugliest things I've ever heard a member of Congress say. Joe Biden has blood on his hands? That's just despicable.
But where I was getting to is, it sounds like a lot of our friends in the Republican Party are echoing, you're echoing what we hear from the legislature in Iran, from Vladimir Putin. It sounds like, I started today off by going, the people who hate America are attacking us again. And our Republican friends are doing it.
Isn't that funny? You're young. I'm an old fart, but you're young. But I know you've read about back in the day when the left was the blame America folk, right? I think Gene Kirkpatrick in the Reagan administration went after the left for always blaming America. You're right, Rick. Right now, it's my former party. It's the right that blames America for Russia invading Ukraine. And they're doing the same thing here. They blame America at every chance they can. This Tucker Carlson, J.D. Vance out of Ohio, some of the crap, I caught my language, I watched it, some of the crap J.D. Vance has been saying, blaming us for everything. What an ugly aspect of the right.
Yeah. No, and this is the thing that gets me. And they're throwing all this stuff out without any attempt to have a solution or a way forward. It's all attack, attack, attack. And look, how do we solve this problem? This has been going on my entire lifetime.
Since Israel's founding, Rick, Israel has been surrounded by neighbors who do not believe Israel has a right to exist. Period.
Right.
Could you imagine, Rick Smith, living in a neighborhood? I know what your neighborhood's like. You probably have a big fancy house and you live in a neighborhood with a bunch of other big fancy houses. Imagine every one of your neighbors didn't believe you had a right to live. And in fact, they wrote up constitutions in their houses pledging to destroy you. That's what Israel's lived with for 75 years. You're never going to have peace with that. The only way you get peace in the Middle East is if you eradicate, I mean, get rid of the people who want to get rid of Israel. That means, Rick, Israel has to go into Gaza and, I mean, wipe Hamas off the face of the earth. Period. And by the way, that's the best thing for the Palestinian people. Yeah, you're not buying any of what I just said. I can tell by the look on your face.
No, I understand it. I'm trying to see. Here's where I'm at, and I'll be quite frank. And I said this yesterday. I don't know enough about the situation to say what you've said. I understand that if you've got a situation where two parties can't get along, one of them's got to go. I get that. How much of Hamas is the Palestinian people? How much of this is intertwined? How much of it is? I don't know. I mean, you're the person who's the expert on this. Tell me, what don't we know?
Well, remember, Hamas is a terrorist organization, yep. And they happen to be the ruling government of Gaza. They're also extremely popular with Palestinians in the West Bank, but they're terrorists, and they haven't had an election since 2006. Maybe about half of the Palestinian people in Gaza support them, but the other half, they can't do anything. And part of the problem, Rick, is all of the other Arab countries use the Palestinians as a proxy to try to make life miserable for Israel. And we were just at a point where Trump started it and Biden's continued it, where some of the more moderate Arab countries were normalizing relationships with Israel. Iran wanted to stop that, which is why they had Hamas do what they did 3 days ago.
Okay, because look, you know, as I'm being told, look, you know, Gaza, the unemployment rate in the Gaza area is like 90% for 18.
It's gross. It's a mess.
And it's a mess on all sides. So, you know, you're saying go after Hamas, which, you know, I'm all for. You know, go after terrorists. Absolutely. If you're the problem, you go. I get that. But you know, what do you do with all of the
then what?
What do you
yeah,
do with
then what?
With all of the people who are desperate. When you have desperation and you have desperate conditions, desperate people do desperate things.
Right. So here's what should be done. Remember, in 2005, Israel gave Gaza back. Israel left Gaza and said, all right, Palestinians, it's yours. You run it. And then they picked Hamas and away we go. Israel's going to have to take Gaza back. And that's, by the way, what's going to happen. This is going to be ugly. They're going to take Hamas back. And then, you know what? They should turn to Egypt and Jordan and say, you take all these Palestinian people. And Israel, Rick, should then say, we're going to make Gaza part of Israel. Because, by the way, Rick, the Muslims and the Arabs who live in Israel right now are freer, happier, and more prosperous than Muslims and Arabs who live in any of their neighboring countries. Because they're freer in Israel. Israel's not perfect, but it's a democracy. So the Palestinians would be better off if Gaza was part of Israel. Man, look at you and I going down this road.
Yeah, no, I'm listening to what you're saying. I'm absorbing
it. But that's a minority view. My view is a minority
view. Yeah, no, I'm absorbing it. I'm not on board, but I'm absorbing, and I'm going to think about this, because
we'll continue this.
No, because look, at some point there's got to be a way forward in this, because it seems like this keeps happening, you know, every so often where an attack happens and then Israel responds overwhelmingly, which is going to happen. You're going to see massive death and destruction, and it's always the poor and the working class who suffer in all of this stuff. It's always the most desperate, the most at the margin people who struggle in this, and the people who are at the top who make the decisions, they walk away from it. It's like, that's where my frustration is.
I get it, and I hear it. Yeah. And I would just add one more thing. Hamas, the ruling government of all those poor people, has purposely, over the last 18 years, made their people miserable. They've taken all the money and used it for their terror activities. All the money that would have gone to jobs and hospitals and schools. Hamas is responsible for the conditions in Gaza. They need to be eliminated.
Yeah. So last question on this I got for you. What do we do with this?
Well, Israel's our greatest ally on the planet. And by the way, Rick, I think Biden said today 14 known Americans have been killed, and at least 10 Americans are being held hostage right now. Can you imagine a situation in a couple days where Hamas is parading American hostages through the streets of Gaza? This is our war too, period.
Well, we'll see. Joe, as always, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Hey, Rick, I watch my language. I love you.
I love the fact that you did. Thanks so much, Joe. Our good friend Joe Walsh. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break, back with your thoughts after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Let's go to the phone lines. Got John in Los Angeles on line one. John, what's on your mind? How are you?
Hey, Rick. How are you? I'm okay. It sounds like you're friends with this Joe, what is his name, Walsh?
Yeah, Joe Walsh.
Yeah. A few years back, I had a friend, she's since died, I believe, but she was Jewish, and when we had a discussion, she had no concept that the one kibbutz that she had lived in for a while back was built on a town that was a Palestinian town. And it sounds like this guy has no concept of how Israel was formed. And it was just plopped down on top of a bunch of people, and they were squeezed out, forced out, pissed on, and pushed over. Now, you know, they act as if everything sprouted up with manifest destiny, like this country, but it didn't. It wasn't free. It wasn't easy, and it wasn't clean, this Israel. And when people wonder why the neighbors are angry, all the neighbors used to be the indigenous who were squashed on and sat on and kicked over like bovine excrement. What do you expect? What does he expect?
Yeah,
too much. That's what I think.
No, I appreciate it, John. I appreciate the thoughts.
You have a nice day, Rick.
Thanks so much. No, I look, as I said from the beginning, you know, there's a history here that goes well back before I was born. And there doesn't seem to be a pathway forward. And you know, people are dug in on their sides. And again, nobody's talking about solutions on how we fix this. And, you know, what I do know is every time there's one of these attacks, the response is, you know, overwhelming. The pain and the suffering is overwhelming. And then we dig in even deeper until the next time and the next time. I don't know the way forward. And I'm not pretending that I do. My point is it looks like, you know, here at home, again, this is another moment for our Republican Party to join in with the people who hate this country to attack us even more. But I appreciate the thoughts. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday I talked about the Reuters report that pointed out, hey, the rich are getting richer, and everyone else, well, not so much. And look, shouldn't be shocked, shouldn't be surprised. And this is one of the things that I'm really concerned about the 2024 election, because, you know, I had lunch today with a friend who was saying, you know, hey, you know, things are hard. You know, the prices of everything have gone up. My wages haven't gone up enough. You know, and the reality is corporate America, they're doing very well. Thank you very much. Shareholders are doing well. CEOs are doing well. Why do you think we're seeing all these strikes? Why do you think workers are finally saying I've had enough already? But here to share some thoughts on where we are. And again, inequality growing again. That's why I've asked our good friend Mateus Vernengo to come talk with us. Mateus is a professor at Bucknell University, one of my economic gurus. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick. Always a pleasure to be here.
So what do you make of this latest bit of numbering that says, look, you know, things are going up. The top 1%, they're almost at the all-time high again. During the pandemic, actually reached the all-time high. What do you make of these numbers?
Not a surprise. I'm sorry to say, you know, this is to a great extent the fact that we couldn't pass some of the legislation that Biden wanted with the larger fiscal package, you know, the Build Back Better, you know, that ended up not passing in full. We did reduce poverty during the pandemic, actually, because some of those programs of helping people, you know, stay at home instead of being kicked out, of receiving enough money so that they can sort of, have food, that not having to pay college, debt that we're again paying, all of those things, more or less reduced some of the problems. At the beginning of the pandemic, real wages went up. Of course, as you said, from then on, we have, the price of oil went up, the snags in the supply chain, corporations, being able to take advantage of all of that. So prices went up, wages have sort of stagnated in comparison to the price of all of those things. So real wages are down, and we're back to the same patterns as before. We are cutting spending. We are again charged, people have to pay back their debts on college debt. Rents are going up through the roof. So that's one of the elements that kept inflation going a little bit further. Price of oil is again going up, but all of those things. So it's the return to things as normal. And also, I should say, from this last year, the fact that Republicans won the narrowly, but won the House gives them some room for doing things. I mean, we were very lucky that we didn't get a shutdown, but I'm not sure that's not going to happen, in November. I mean, it's not clear they're going to get a speaker. And all of that points to no extra fiscal spending. At the same time, the Fed has hiked interest rates, and interest rates higher, you know, mortgages are higher, you know, rents are higher. So this hits everybody very heavily. The middle class is sort of squeezed. So these are not new patterns, I'm sorry to say. It's not a surprise that inequality has gone up. And I should say this also has global implications. So there are many countries that are on the verge of severe financial crisis because the Fed hiking interest rates is also puts all debtors. So if you have a mortgage, it's on flexible rates, your mortgage payments go up. If you are a developing country and the interest rate in the United States goes up, it's essentially the same thing. It's, you know, you have to pay higher interest and hike your rates of interest so that, you know, to avoid capital flight and whatnot. So this is a complicated situation for the world, let alone all the other geopolitical things that, you know. So these are complicated times.
And the thing is, you know, while it's bad here, the rest of the globe is experiencing, you know, things, you know, as bad, if not worse.
Oh, sure. As I was saying, I just came back from India, and I'm somewhat jet lagged, it's a part of the world. Pakistan is one of the most. Pakistan, you know, India is exactly between Pakistan and Sri Lanka, two of the, you know, of the highest sort of indebted countries that are in significant problems, We're talking of countries that, you know, really need to grow fast and catch up, and, you know, the levels of inequality and poverty in places like India are humongous. So there is a great disadvantage, so to speak. So what the United States does has global implications too. And so these pro-business, pro-corporation policies, which I think to some extent favoring not just the elites in the United States, the corporations, the CEOs, as you were saying, in the United States, is also their equivalents, their pars in those developing countries. So it's the working class, both in the developing world and in America, that are suffering.
You know, it's obscene when you look at here, you know, the top 1% of households by income holding, you know, something almost 27% of the household wealth in this country. In other countries, it's actually much worse than that. But I mean, 27% held by the top 1% is obscene.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, this is Gilded Age sort of levels. I joke with my students, you know, I always ask them, you know, tell me the name of billionaires of the, you know, Gilded Age era. And I'm always glad that, you know, I'm always afraid that they're not going to know any history, but they can come up with names, you know, the Morgans and the Carnegies and the, you know, Rockefellers. And then I ask them, you know, tell me billionaires of now. And they all, you know, we have tons of billionaires, the Bezos, the, you know, Elon Musks and, you know, and Zuckerbergs and so on and so forth. And then I ask them, tell me a billionaire, you know, millionaire, you know, iconic figure equivalent of the 50s and 60s. And there are none. And there are none because, you know, we tax them the hell out of them, 95%, you know, marginal tax rate. I should say the most creative answer I got was one Hugh Hefner, but which, you know, I was impressed. That kid knew about Playboy. But, but, you know, I says, no, dude, he was just a tiny millionaire. I mean, in comparison to all the other stuff, it's not like Hugh Hefner controlled the world. So if you were a teenage boy, perhaps, but... But not.
He had everything every teenage boy ever wanted.
Yes. But yeah. You know, but there aren't, and you know that tells you something. You know, it's funny that economists call that the golden age of capitalism. That period. And I joke. I mean, one has to be careful because, you know, if you were, I always say, you know, if you were, you know, a woman or African American in the United States, let alone in certain other parts of the world, we still have colonies at that point. But, you know, it was more difficult, no doubt. But, you know, it's called the Golden Age because wages were high, there was hope for the working class, and so on and so forth. But, you know, that was sandwiched by two Gilded Ages. And we have essentially a world that it's not very different than the Gilded Age of, you know, the Rockefellers. And they're in charge. They're in charge in, you know, in Congress. So we do have data that shows that, you know, the vote of a billionaire, you know, counts more. I mean, they get the legislation they want. They got the Supreme Court they want. So that's the problem with wealth inequality. It's to what extent wealth inequality is compatible with the democratic society, with the ideals of the democratic society. And that's why I think, as you were saying, people are angry, people are not happy, you know, people think that this is unsustainable.
And this is why I think you're seeing a lot of strike activity, and you're seeing a lot of workers who have had enough, because, you know, we do know the history. You know, I think back to my grandparents' generation. They fought for better wages, hours, conditions, and they lived through a great era of prosperity. In fact, you know, I saw this great, you know, graph where they, you know, they had the, you know, the era of great prosperity from 47 to 79, and then the great regression from 1980 until now, of which, you know, in that prosperous era, you know, a meritocracy emerged more.
We gave them, for example, just an example. This October, we were paying against college debt. And think of this, GI Bill, you know, they gave, fair enough, these people gave their blood, you know, but, you know, they gave free education, you know, so a whole generation that basically went to college for free, they made the middle class. So not only you got, you know, college for free, you know, basically buying a house was heavily subsidized. So essentially the two things that make the bulk of what makes the middle class. So if you're middle class, if you have a house, it's where most of your savings are, and you have some sort of diploma, and, you know, and you have, you know, your ability to go out and get a decent, I mean, there is still a gap between the wages of skilled, you know, educated, college educated kids and workers unskilled without, you know, a high school diploma. Those are very, you know, sort of significant and persistent differences. And, you know, if you are democratizing, you're allowing people to get that education, of course you make a difference. And so all of that has vanished. And I agree. I mean, I think that's the part that I like. I think that there is a positive anger. So the unions going out and negotiating and seeing more of these, you know, United Auto Workers stopping, you know, I think that that's a positive sign. I think that, you know, hopefully, you know, there is some hope that this model, you know, is unsustainable and some change is needed. But of course, you know, there is the fear. I mean, one has to remember in the 30s when, you know, this sort of things happen, the two alternative models, you know, Stalinism and fascism and the Nazis were out there and we had Father Coughlin and, you know, those things in the United States, those things did exist. And we have Trump and, you know, and the election, God knows what happens next year. It's not like it is a case closed and simple election, you know. I should say in Brazil, at least, you know, we had, you know, a year after actually January 6th in Brazil was January 8th. And a very similar thing. They invaded Congress. They, you know, tried a coup, and Bolsonaro, who was behind this, he's not in jail, but he is ineligible. So he cannot run for president in the next election. He cannot run until 2032, in which he will be really old. So the Brazilian judicial system acted promptly, and sort of, you know, made the connections of him being, you know, linked to this movement, and he cannot be elected. I'm sorry to say that didn't happen in our case here, and so you know, it's a real danger, and God knows what happens, you know, with a Trump presidency.
Yeah, but, you know, again, I come back to these numbers and this, you know. You know, the economy that was, the economy that is, and, you know, the brave new world that can be. You know, I hope we're in a transition period, because I'm hoping we've had enough of this. You know, I'm hoping we've had enough of one guy taking 27% of the economy and shoving it in their pocket.
I think for certain things, you know, certainly there has been a new. So the Biden administration has talked. Jake Sullivan, he's a foreign affairs, you know, advisor, has it's not the right name of the position, but, you know, Jake Sullivan has talked about a new Washington consensus, and there are things that are important. So I think one is there has a consensus even with Republicans that, you know, some degree of protection with regard to China is an important thing. That some jobs. You know, have to, manufacturing jobs including, have to come back to the United States. I don't think that many will, but some will. And the CHIPS Act is a testament to that. And so some of those are coming. Some of those actually creating problems, you know, the fact that some of these electric cars and battery, you know, are more, you know, mechanized and require less workers and hurt, you know, unions. So, but yeah, some of these jobs are coming back. It has a preoccupation, Biden. I don't think that that's a consensus. So Biden has a preoccupation with unions. He showed that at picket lines and whatnot. There is a consensus, I think, that industrial policy, all economists are talking now that industrial policy is necessary. And so that we need to be concerned with having key manufacturing jobs and sectors within the country and so on and so forth. That's a consensus. But the notion that that goes with protecting unions, and I think that that's sincere and true in Biden. I'm not sure that that is a consensus. So I don't think that even within the Democratic Party, that's a consensus. The Democratic Party still has a strong neoliberal, you know, pro-business sort of, as you know, constituency. And the Republicans are just play lip service to this kind of agenda. It is very much a corporate party. So that, I think, it's problematic that that party is not completely there. So it is an agenda that puts at the center the American economy, but not necessarily American workers, for sure American corporations.
I know I ask you this all the time, but you know, there's still talk of a potential recession down the road. I've heard. I know for some it's a fantasy. They're hoping, they're wishing, because it will hurt Biden. It'll hurt the Democrats in the election in 2024, and probably the only way Republicans maintain power in the House. Do we have still a fear of a potential recession, especially because, you know, wages are rising? I got people telling me, you know, those unions that are asking for those pay increases, they're going to cause a recession. Should we be concerned about that?
Not the unions, the wages. I mean, I wish they got, you know, the wage hikes. So the wage hikes and a little bit of inflation, actually a little bit of inflation, if comes out of that, good. So I don't care. Provided the wages, you know, sort of stay ahead of inflation, I have no problem with that. My fear of recession is not from the higher wages. My fear of recession is what the Fed will do. If the Fed keeps hiking rates of interest and they promise another hike, and if Republicans are playing with fire, and we know that they want to play with fire. So they want to see the whole thing. I mean, there is a group within the Republican Party that they want to see chaos. And so if they shut down the economy, and if the shutdown is prolonged enough, if the Fed hikes the rate of interest because of the fear, the last numbers in the labor market were again relatively strong, 300 and something percent. It has continued to be strong. So if they decide that they want to slow down the economy, remember Larry Summers, not a Republican, Larry Summers, Treasury Secretary of Bill Clinton, advisor to Obama, at least not inside the White House now with Biden. So outside, but an influential voice within the Democratic Party. He said that we needed, you know, at least 2 years of more than 5% of unemployment, or at least 1 year of more than 10% unemployment in order to control inflation for sure. So he's been asking the Fed to be more, you know, hawkish and hike the rate of interest even more. And so I'm afraid that it cannot be ruled out. It's one of the things that, you know, keeps me up at night, is the possibility of a recession. Having said that, you know, we've been talking, as you said, for a while about this, and you know, if the short shutdown, if the Fed, comes down and this is the last one of the hikes, and then they slowly start reducing the rate, maybe we do achieve the, you know, so-called soft landing. So it's not impossible. So we'll see. I mean, nobody has the, you know, crystal ball to know exactly what will happen. Economists very often, you know, get things wrong, and you know, I'm certainly no better than other economists at that. I do get things wrong all the time.
Well, we shall see. But as always, Mateus, I appreciate your input and your expertise. Good stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, our good friend Mateus Fernango. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1933. That was the day that 40 armed cotton growers shot at a group of striking workers in the small town of Pixley, California. That year, a wave of labor unrest had swept through the fields of California's agricultural industry. Nearly 50,000 workers participated in strikes throughout the year. The Agricultural Workers Industrial Union led many of the strikes. The American Federation of Labor also led two walkouts.
Workers were angry over declining wages and the harsh working conditions of agricultural life. The Depression had slashed wages. Cotton field workers in the San Joaquin Valley had seen their wages cut by as much as 75%. 3/4 of those workers were Mexican. As cotton harvest season neared, the workers organized to strike. They demanded a dollar for every 100 pounds of cotton they picked, and recognition of their union. The growers offered 60 cents. At the peak of the strike, an estimated 12 to 18,000 workers had walked off the job. Anger mounted. Armed growers attacked striking workers, demanding they return to work or leave California. Strike leaders were arrested. In Pixley, the growers formed a Farmers Protective Association. They claimed to have as many as 600 members. Reportedly, one manager of a cotton gin told the farmers, "The time has come for us to take the law into our own hands and drive the strikers from our farms." The simmering tensions boiled over. As highway patrolmen looked on, a band of growers shot into a group of unarmed strikers. At least 2 strikers fell dead. The violence resulted in public outcry and federal intervention. The workers received federal relief, and a mediator helped to settle the strike. And in the settlement, the workers would receive 75 cents per 100 pounds of cotton. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So on Thursday, you've got the culinary workers who are going to hit the picket line at MGM Resorts and Caesars Entertainment Casinos in Las Vegas. Thousands of workers are going to take to the streets as part of this massive, what was it, 50,000 plus hospitality workers in Las Vegas who are, fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, saying, "Hey, look, we earn a reasonable living. We earn these companies massive, massive profits. I don't like to use the word deserve, because that sounds like almost like an entitlement. Oh, we deserve this. No, they earn this money. They earn every penny of it and then some." These casinos, wildly profitable. And then again, across the board, I mean, you look at the fact, the distribution of income in this country, when 1% of the people in this country are pocketing almost 27% of what's created, there's a problem here. And you fix that with a tax code. It's what we did in the old days. And I love the way Mateus pointed out, tell me the Gilded Age, the robber barons. And people could do that. Tell me today's robber barons. And people can do that. Point to the 50s. Who was the billionaire of that? Oh, wait a minute. There wasn't. There were rich people. There were rich people, trust me. But there were no gazillionaires. Because we, as a matter of policy, taxed them. Massive estate tax, income tax, a top marginal tax rate of 92%, a corporate tax of 56%. And then you have this thing, it's people who are paying those taxes. Yeah, working people are paying those taxes. But understand, if you want me to buy your product, it's got to be competitively priced, which means you're going to take less profit. That's how that works. We're in a moment right now where it's maximum profits. We're going to line our pockets with as much as we can get. Hooray for us and screw those working people. So it's good to see folks in the streets. Thrilled with it. Absolutely thrilled. Interesting news coming out of New York. George Santos has been charged with... What was it, 23 counts of this massive indictment, a superseding indictment is what they've called it. One count of conspiracy to commit offenses against the United States,
two counts of wire fraud, two counts of making materially false statements to the FEC, two counts of falsifying records submitted to obstruct the FEC, two counts of aggravated identity theft, and one count of access device fraud. Basically, what he was doing is he was anybody who had given him money as a campaign contribution, he just kept charging him and charging him and charging him, even when it went beyond the FEC's individual contribution limits. Just kept churning and just kept, you know, basically stealing from people. He's now been charged with this 23-count indictment, and we'll see what happens. They point on one occasion, Santos charged $12,000 to the contributor's card, ultimately transferring the money to his personal account, which is a no-no. It's a no-no. You can't do that. And I find it interesting that now is when they've decided to, you know, to do this. This doesn't seem like it should have taken this long, but here we are. And finally, remember Don Blankenship? He was the guy who was the head of the coal mine, you know, back in 2010. That had a mine disaster in West Virginia that killed 29 miners. He was convicted of a misdemeanor related to that. Well, he tried to sue news organizations who said it was a felony, you know, for defamation and all kinds of stuff. Well, the Supreme Court threw that all out. They declined to consider overturning the landmark case that gives news organizations a little bit of protection. And couldn't be a nicer guy. This is the guy who said, you know, we don't get paid to put up safety precautions. We get paid to run coal. You know, so your safety and the safety of working people be damned. It's about the money in his pocket. Now, he's not going to suffer from black lung. But those poor workers who were down in the mines doing his dirty work, they will. So the heck with him. Anyway, good place to end. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Something I said got under your skin, on your mind, I want to hear. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Again, thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.